Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello and welcome to The Gallery. ZU UK are theatre artists, activists and pedagogues. Ever since their groundbreaking all-night version of Medea, performed in multiple locations between 2009 and 2011, including the Hayward Gallery, Lift Festival and Edinburgh Fringe, they have been renowned for their distinctive approach to interactive performance and audience participation. The multi-award-winning Hotel Medea was followed by a number of projects using telephony and sound technology, including most famously the binaural dinner date, which has been performed over 250 times internationally since its first outing in 2016. Founded by artistic director Persis Jaj Maravalla and executive director Jorge Lopez Ramos, ZU UK is recognized as a world-leading theatre company in immersive theatre, although this is a label they have challenged and sought to redefine by placing an emphasis on empathy at the centre of their work with the audience. In 2020, Ramos and Maravalla published the Post-Immersive Manifesto, co-authored with Joseph Dunn Howry and Bart Simon for the International Journal of Performance Arts and Digital Media. ZU UK also run their own master's program in contemporary performance at the University of Greenwich. In this conversation, we explore various routes and influences leading towards ZU UK's multifaceted way of working, which places equal value on physical training and binaural technology, politics and poetics, working in Britain and working in Brazil. This conversation took place on Zoom on the 1st of June 2020.
I'm really keen to reinstate the artist in the process of knowledge production. When we think about how theater is made, how performance is made, this conversation, in my view, has to absolutely put the artist at the center of it. And my approach is, you know, it's kind of emerged from some of the previous work that I've done, where I talk about such thing as the artist's idiom and how a particular artist or a particular company develops a particular vocabulary over a period of time that they work together. And often there is an interrelation between the various works that have developed over time. So it's very hard to kind of like look at just the piece in isolation and then pull it apart and analyze it, you know, unless you actually understand where it sort of comes from longer term. And that's the reason why I want to go back to the early beginnings and retrace your steps as artists before you got to the point where you're now making the work as you do with speech and sound at the center of it. Particularly interesting in this respect is something that actually is relevant to both of you as artists, and that's this idea that when we all think back to like the 1990s and so on, we might remember how, you know, everybody was doing physical theater, you know, and there was that sort of, you know, tradition being at the center of thinking about how we resist the text-based legacy of theater making and so on. But now it seems that a lot of people are moving towards speech and sound and technology. And I'm just interested in that paradigm shift and what that means. To start with, I'll take you back. I'll ask you to revisit your early years as artists and tell us the story of how you discovered theatre and performance and its potential as young people.
First of all, I just want to say thank you, Dushka. It's really nice to have this talk with you because, as I mentioned before, I hardly really ever get the chance to talk about this kind of stuff that we do, which is so embedded in sound. So it's nice to have that time. Often when we get interviewed, our work like rarely focuses on the aspect of sound because there's so many other things that kind of front end the work, and the sound is a huge driver, but is also invisible. But I do actually work with sound as the main driver of communication for me, as opposed to physicality and kind of visual, you know, visualness. So it's really nice to be able to like have this chance. So I came actually, funnily enough, I came into theatre via sound. My interest in the beginning was like experimental music. So I came really quite late. I was already around 24. And when I started to work within the legacy of Jerzy Grotowski. And so my background is entirely physical, and that is important in terms of sound. The body is really, really important to us, even though, as you've correctly mentioned, there's been this shift for where we used to work. I think this is true for George as well, where we used to work so much on the performer's body, and now we work very much on the participant's body. However, even within the work of Grotowski, it was very, very much focused on the voice as an equal kind of tool. And it was a tool of elucidating meaning as much as the literary meaning, you know, any textual meaning or sort of dramaturgical meaning. The voice carried meaning. And so my early work was with dealing with voice as the main vehicle for sort of intercommunication to audiences, but through very ritual and shamanic practices. And this goes back actually a bit more to the fact that I was brought up in the Zoroastrian faith. And as a child, I was quite deeply lessoned in reciting the litany. I mean, we call it the litany, but these are actually just sequences of sound. I mean, I know that now. They are in a language. They are in Avestan, and a kind of early Pahlavi dialect, but their meaning was located in the sound of them. So it was rooted in how they were said. So, of course, we're just talking about like reverberations and the power of repetition and the strength of the resonance and your tone and things like that. So since a child, I was trained to recite these very long mantras, you know, essentially mantras are just sounds, but the closest translation of the Sanskrit word, which is mantra, is spell in English. It's the noun spell. And the term originally comes from a Persian word. It has Persian roots, and it means and it signifies a formula that the repetition of will dispel like diseases or illnesses or negativity and kind of bring forth, you know, positivity and blessings. My grandparents were immigrants to Yemen. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So although we come from Yemen, my grandparents actually don't, and originally we're Iranian, and my father's parents are from India, but Zoroastrian Indians called Parsis. So my ancestry is Zoroastrian, which is from Iran, from Persia. And it's a very, very, very old religion. It's the kind of beginning of the Judaic Christian tradition of religion, i.e. monotheistic, but it's very, very close, still very close to paganism and animism and kind of very, very rooty, earthy origins. The reason why I even mentioned my childhood is because I think it's important in terms of the way that we think about sound in the West is like really connected to meaning of the words, you know, very sort of literary. What do we understand by the words that are said to us? And what I think I learned as a child was that the sounds of the utterances were believed to have this magical effect when they were uttered with the right intent. So, you know, the ancients were really sure of this magical effects of the mantras, and so am I. And the key is in the vibration. And I think even now, even when I'm working with things that are so far removed from shamanic ritual practices, to this day, I still listen out for this vibration in everything that we do. And if I don't hear it, then it's out. It doesn't make it into the work. Because even though it might be like meaningless gibberish, what's interesting about the meaningless gibberishness of it is that the priests who taught me and my grandmother and everyone, for example, didn't really know what they were saying. Really, it was unintelligible to them, and it's been handed down for centuries, like orally and unintelligibly, and that's how it can create this sort of transcendental mood, because you have to go beyond meaning in a way that working with modern languages can never escape. You can never escape for that. So even now when I'm using my voice on the voiceovers or when I'm training the actors, I'm always, always searching for this quality, for this reverberation, working with my voice in that way as a kind of maybe not, you know, a healing force, but certainly a sort of calming force or one that engages, you know.
How did you enter those circles of working with Grotowski and ways of training?
So I met Jonathan Grieve. He had been trained by Yola Zinkutis, and she was the wife of Zbigniew Zinkutis from the Theatre Lab in Poland. She became our main reference. Jonathan was already into experimental music and he was with Contrastate, and so I was around those kinds of post-punk industrial movement experimental noise scenes, but really through him. Like, he was absolutely the gateway to that world. I wasn't at all privy to any of that. I didn't have any contact with any of that before I met him.
Whenabouts was this?
That was like 94.
Okay. So you, obviously, when you discovered the legacy of Grotowski's work, found ways of understanding or reincorporating that personal experience in...
Yeah. We were an ensemble group called Paraactive. And Jonathan was at that point the director. But, you know, very quickly, I also became the leader of training and we worked collaboratively in running the company, running the ensemble.
Yes. And I remember you saying, actually, on one occasion, how this was a very rigorous training and a very, and there was a discipline underscoring this particular way of working that then translated into how you work when you don't work with that particular heritage.
It was extremely hardcore. We were working in really difficult spaces because we didn't have money. So it's all kind of on concrete floors and things like that. And we were throwing our bodies around in this kind of search for some sort of authenticity. And we worked very long hours and we were very strict and very kind of disciplined. We accepted anyone who wanted to come and work with us because mostly people just didn't stay. Like, the ensemble that stayed were people who were very tough. And it was a sort of situation where if you weren't bleeding in the warm-up, you weren't working hard enough. So our entry point levels were really, really high. And it was very tough physically. And so we worked a lot with the body and how we carried that aspect through. I mean, when I then started working with Georges, I think he adopted that. I mean, I think that he can talk about that, but that was something that I definitely brought to our collaboration, which wasn't very easy, especially working at that point in a Brazilian context where people are a little bit like, chilled.
So is there a direct significance of the post-punk context to this particular work of Paraactive as a company? What was the sort of synergy between the post-punk experimental music scene and the Grotowskian system of training?
Well, I think that there was always this tension between discipline and spontaneity, between the rigor of the form and the kind of responsiveness to the moment. So we worked a lot with these tensions. And with the Grotowski work, what we were seeing is that it can be quite... I've seen so much work that has been inspired by Grotowski, which is mannered and sort of sedate. And like, it is repetitive, but it's also sort of a bit careful somehow. And we were absolutely not that. Like, I think we had taken from a post-punk context, what is freedom? So there's a lot of entanglement with a kind of strange healing, but we were like really healing ourselves through noise, through explosive and overstated, you know, whatever the opposite of understated is, you know, this kind of exaggerated sound fields where things could get very like clashy and very dissonant. And we were looking specifically for those contradictions and we were working in those tensions and we weren't afraid to go to those places where it could be very, yeah, like, you know, ugly, you know, in the sense that there's this idea that violence can't be healing. And I think we wanted to provoke that. Like, is that true? Because both Jonathan and I were very, very influenced by rave culture and gig culture, and especially Jonathan was involved with like experimental sound and music and bands that were pushing the edges of what even could be considered music, if things can still be considered music after a certain BPM or after a certain intensity. So yeah, we were pushing those edges, I think, but that stuff came much more from Jonathan's background than it did from mine.
And is there anything to say about any formal training or education that might have fed into this? Was there any kind of other educational context that might have facilitated those connections you were making with people that you worked with?
Or... I didn't go to drama school. I didn't go to anything like that, yeah. It was very, very off the street. Just cobbled together a group of people. Some people had drama school training, I think, but a lot of us had just randomly crashed into Paractive. One thing that was really formal was that we did train quite rigorously in methodologies. So for the voice and stuff, we were very following the line of Zygmunt Mollick and taking this voice training, which was like super located in the body. Across all of this time, I've been working with different people who represent different phases of the Grotowski timeline. Because, you know, he had like a lot of different movements. So I also worked with the early Teatro Laboratorium, mm-hmm. with Renner, and then of course Jola's connection to it was mm-hmm. at that phase as well, and Zygmunt Mollick. And then I also worked with Teatro Sol, the Haitian, Maud Robert, who was a trainer in the Grotowski Center for a long time, but she was very much at the Theatre of Sources stage. And so I did a lot of work with her. And that was really important in terms of vibration, in terms of that kind of style of working through the spine and the ritual, Haitian ritual aspects. And then later I worked quite a lot with people like Gaping, and also another guy called Georges Parenchi, who was the main student of Zygmunt Mollick. So throughout that whole phase, I had a lot of connections with different phases of Grotowski, and all of them were very voice-based. It was always very voice-based. And even if, when I went to the work center, I always worked with them on this text that I learned as a child. I always like was developing it.
Great. Thank you so much. Shall we move to this Georges now? And hear about your journey, Georges, from Brazil to London. What were your early exposures to performance, and what was it that determined your interest in this particular form of creative expression?
I was in Rio until I was 18, 19, and then I came to the UK. And I think one of the strongest references early on for me would have been my father, because not only was he in TV, soaps, film, cinema, as an actor, as a director, as a writer. He grew up in the sort of 60s, 70s, and in Brazil, all the TV was made by a very small number of people. It was all live, so they all had to rotate, they had to write, they had to direct, they had to perform. And he was very politically engaged with the setup of the Workers' Party in the late 70s, early 80s. So his work was inseparable from the dictatorship in Brazil. And I was born at a time where he couldn't register me straight away. Otherwise, they might find where he was hiding through my registration of birth. So inevitably, one way or another, his activities, his stances were very influential, whether or not I was conscious at the time. Then later on, I never really fitted in culturally because of my appearance, because of my connection or not with the culture. I never had many friends. We moved a lot in Rio from school to school. So I guess my first engagement with performing was as a kind of a way to become this joker person, this kind of to distract attention from the awkwardness. And I was very overweight as well, and I used to be bullied for that. So I guess my performance persona started developing a way as to distract attention from myself into this entertainer. And then I got involved in youth theater. But I think one of my first strong references was Boal. When I went to work for a short course with Boal and his company Rio, I realized how externally, out of Brazil, there was an enormous respect for his work and the work of the Theater de Oppressed. And yet in Brazil, there was a huge disdain from the art scene and the theater scene, dismissing it as not theater. It wasn't artful enough. It wasn't aesthetic enough. It was about social impact. And that means that, oh, very nice, but it's not really theater. And I remember that really surprising me, that whatever they were doing and the value of what they were doing somehow could be dismissed because of this higher understanding of something that they weren't part of. And I guess with Boal's Theatre de Oppressed, with capoeira, martial arts art form that I got involved as a teenager in Brazil and trained, and later on with Japanese Butoh dance in my 20s, I think these are kind of art forms from outsiders. They're things that look a bit weird, don't quite fit into the culture that they were created, and they're a sort of form of resistance as well. So I think I was attracted to those forms because they weren't the established norm of what art was or what everyone else was doing. I was very interested in those art forms. I ended up spending a long time working with capoeira and Butoh just before I met Jaji. And that was one of our kind of links, was the interest in physical training and various cultural contexts for training. That was how we first met, kind of a training course for Capoeira Angola with a common master we had. But I guess because I came to the UK to study, and I came to a specific course at a specific college, which was European Theatre Arts at Rosa Bruford College, the course had just been created. There was no legacy. It was created by someone called Emilio Romero, who's long left the university, and the team. And it was in that course that I was exposed to not just the work of Grotowski in bite-sized form, nothing at all like what Jaji's just mentioned, but also Tadeusz Kantor, Laban, and so on. It was a very expansive course in terms of dipping your toe into a number of different, very interesting methodologies. So I guess it was a kind of a parallel journey of what these things that I was very attracted to, and then the course itself. And because I really couldn't really find a common ground with my colleagues in the year that I was in my course, I didn't feel satisfied that the work was going deep enough. And also, if you come from another country, you're really trying to make the most of that moment and that course. And I guess my colleagues were very young and they weren't quite sure why they were there. So I started my company from my first year in order to be able to explore the things I couldn't within the course. So there was kind of these two parallel journeys of the course going alongside the development of the company.
And what was that, Zecora Ura?
That was Zecora Ura, yeah.
Yeah.
So when the company that I started was based at Rose Bruford, and we would start a new project, we'd do a call out, and then we'd have people from the lighting design course, from the acting course, from the actor musicianship, from European Theatre Arts, from another year, from costume design. So it was like an experimental company that for every new project, we would set up a kind of a line of inquiry or start from a text or a space or whatever, and then devise the production from there.
Okay. What does Zecora Ura mean?
Zecora is the Latin for zebra. Mm-hmm. And Ura is the Basque for running water, but also Japanese for the hidden side. Not that that was our intention. We just found out that later after we made up the name randomly. But strangely enough, it kind of reflected those two interests, which were the Japanese Butoh training and the Brazilian Capoeira Angola training at the time, which ended up being kind of as the meeting point between Zecora Ura and Paraactive, that ended up merging, was also the meeting point for the training that we started to establish for Hotel Medea, and that Jaji started to write with basis not just on those trainings, but a research that we did in the northeast of Brazil.
Okay, so let's spend a little more time on that meeting. How did the two of you meet and decide to then pursue this path together?
So Zecora had come out of a very successful UK tour of a production called Tempest or La Tempestad, which was a mixture of sort of pidgin language, English, Spanish, Shakespeare English, French, Portuguese, restaging of The Tempest with three performers. And we were collaborating with Gabriel Gowing at that moment, who was also involved with some of the like, crossover legacies that we've mentioned today. So Gabriel directed that after we'd done a year of research in Brazil. And then we toured several venues, and it was a very successful format. It was a very successful piece. But I guess a big moment for me was the understanding that if you wanted to grow your company or develop professionally, you'd do something like that, like The Tempest, like we did. And then when all those festivals and venues who hosted it asked you to do something again, they would ask you to do something very similar. A bit more of the same, please.
So you decided that the next piece wasn't going to be the same as The Tempest because you wanted to defy those expectations.
Not necessarily defy the expectations, but just work on something else, investigate something else. Zsa and I had met by that point. And even though The Tempest tour was running its course, we were already talking about this idea of an overnight thing. We weren't sure exactly what it was. We started with the overnight training ideas, overnight workshops, overnight poetically what that period was between, you know, sunset and sunrise. So we were already really interested in that. And also Zsa was working a lot at the time, or had been working at the time, but we were talking about what's expected of a woman from another country, how violent are women allowed to be, a number of questions around womanhood. So around those two moments is when we started sketching out. And then when we realized that we wanted to make something which was going to be very ambitious, with neither company could do it alone, which was Hotel Madeira, is when we decided that we had to work together, we had to combine those forces, otherwise it was going to be impossible to make. When I went back to those venues and those festivals saying, oh, I know you liked The Tempest, but now the next thing is an overnight theater show from midnight to dawn, they all pulled out with the exception of one, who gave us a little bit of R&D money and was very worried but supportive.
Which one was that?
There was this Salisbury International Festival at the time.
What was the year of your meeting, just so we kind of get a foothold in where we are in the narrative?
2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. We met before, 2004, but 2005, 2006 was kind of a more intense.
Okay. Zsa, is that your story as well? Or do you have a slightly different take on those events and the meeting?
I mean, I guess we were just coming from really, really opposite places. It's funny hearing George talk about it because actually I think we were coming from the fact that we were just working so hard and so nonstop for zero support. And we weren't well versed at all in how to get support. We were not connected, or we just didn't have a producer brain in the ensemble. And the last thing that I did with Para Active, I think would have been Zooid Fight Night Experience. Is that right, George? That would have been the last thing, right? So that was like just the most incredible show, like a show that I'm so proud of, that about, I don't know how many people saw, I mean, very few. We took it to Edinburgh and that was an absolute disaster. It was like really misunderstood and slated as this show of racism and stuff. It was really wild. That was like very, very disastrous experience. Especially like what we're talking about in terms of that post-punk aesthetic and just being very aggressive and violent, but also not wanting to be theatre that was like so, a bit like what George is talking about with The Tempest, where there was this kind of hyper-acceptability about the work, and we were really fighting for being provocative and wanting to reframe certain issues, especially diversity, like racial diversity. But you know, everyone was like not getting any recompense whatsoever. We all had other kinds of jobs. A lot of us were on the dole. I was on the dole. we were getting housing benefit and stuff. Those were the days where you could still just about do that. I think it was like probably the last phase of the welfare system that would support artists. I was in the last phase of that. But the work was insanely good. So, but it destroyed us. And at that point now in ParaActive, we were still continuing with the Grotowski training, but we had met Guillermo Gomez Peña. Mm-hmm. And we found in him the right way to speak to the world in terms of all the clashes that we were experiencing in our lives. So we wanted to like be really bold. And I think in Guillermo's work, we were able to take that performance art aspect of just being very in the here and now. We had all the training from the world of Grotowski, all the physical training and the rigor, but we were putting it in this very, very performance art format with a show called Zooid Fight Night Experience. But it was impossible to speak about. It was really difficult to have a vocabulary. We just weren't very good at getting out there and schmoozing. And, you know, we didn't have the right tools, really. And the company just fell apart after that. It was very, very implosive. It failed dramatically in Edinburgh. And so when I picked myself up off the floor and sort of dusted myself off a bit and started to work with George, I just wanted to go back to just something smaller, which then ended up being Hotel Madeo, which is like crazy. Meeting George, in a way, we kind of met in the middle. I think we'd come from slightly opposite directions, where I'd come from, you know, incredible verticality in terms of the training and the knowledge building. It was very, very on the vertical axis. And George was very, very lateral. He was like super, you know, really like anything goes, in the sense that, yes, I can bring something from here and mix it with this and create this. And he was working on a lateral plane. And so we met in this crossing of the two planes, you know, my verticality and his horizontality.
Great. That's a lovely way of putting it. So you decided to make Medea. How long did it take to create this show and to make it a kind of a participatory piece of theater that became a definitive piece of what has been problematically referred to as immersive theater? Mm.
The two things I wanted to mention that go into that question. One is, Jajid said, in a similar way that with her experience in ParaActive, there was no producer, there was no kind of network of influence or privilege or connections that could take that work that was in itself deep and excellent into an opportunity, to a platform, to growth, to funding. You know, I arrived in the UK with no relatives or friends, or there was no one to ask for favors. So by the time we met, the sensation that it doesn't matter if you keep working like a maniac and saying yes to everything, and that isn't enough. There's something that we haven't managed to access for different reasons, for our different experiences, but certainly privileges that we lacked compared to a number of other individuals and organizations that we could see were managing to do all sorts of things or get all sorts of gigs. And I think it was at that moment that I realized that I wanted to do something different, where however long it took, and Hotel Madeira took 6 years to make, but however long it took, that we made sure that we were making the right efforts. Doesn't mean that we succeeded. We succeeded in many ways and failed in many others, but that we were very much aware of that resistance, of that lack of access. And to get Hotel Madeira from nothing to what it then became, it took 6 years of not talking or doing anything else, talking about anything else. This is what we're doing. This is what we're doing. This is what we're doing. And rejection after rejection. One of the first things that we heard from one of the venues was, there is no audience for this kind of work. And it was persistence and just, well, and then you see. But the other thing was about, why do an overnight event? And Jaja and I were in different experiences running a lot of workshops. There was this kind of late 90s, early 2000s of workshop culture, workshop festivals, and masters coming from abroad and running workshops. And I remember Jaja saying how problematic she felt that this relationship between a training legacy and a workshop that people put in their CV, oh, I've done this training because they had a two-day workshop with someone, was really weakening, emptying, and kind of thinning what potentially was a very meaningful work. So at that moment, not only were we rethinking our relationship with audiences, we were rethinking our relationships with peers, with students. And we created at the same time as we wanted to do Hotel Madeira, something called the Drift Residency. Mm. And the Drift Residency was a shift from open workshops where you pay, you attend, and you get what you paid for, to an engagement where you had to come with a project. You could not come empty-handed. So any participant from any artistic discipline could come, but they had to be responsible for this project of theirs. So we had a kind of a more adult relationship with everyone who was there. At the end of the day, they had to be responsible for their work. They had to present their work. They had to develop their work. They had to defend their work. And with Hotel Madeira, it was a similar thing, but with audiences. Well, if someone says, yes, I'll come and stay awake from midnight until dawn with this company that I've never heard of, with this work that I don't know what's about, that means that they've already made a massive leap. We meet at midnight, not with a passerby. We meet with someone who's gone, I'm here, what are we doing? So the level of commitment was completely different. And I think at that moment, which is completely different to what we're doing now, but at that moment, we were interested in that level of meeting of people who were coming with responsibility, with commitment, with presence. They were there, they're ready, they're here. Whatever their ability, they were present.
And what was the first overnight performance that you did? When was it?
So 2008, we did our first test run at Salisbury International Festival. So it is almost impossible to compare what then Hotel Madeira became, but it was the first time with actually a group of people that we went until the morning. From 2006 in Australia was the first overnight workshop. We were doing various overnight invitations to people to stay awake the night,
yeah, work through the night. House. I remember something at Oval yeah. House. Do you remember
yeah.
that?
All night, yeah. Mm. But I think 2008 was the first time where we named it Hotel Madeira, and people who came had a ticket. And we said, yeah, let's see what this feels like.
Yeah. And
it wasn't ready. It wasn't ready at all. Yeah.
It wasn't. Well, how did you emerge with that realization that it wasn't ready?
Oh, wait. We didn't realize it wasn't ready. We knew it wasn't ready.
No, I'm just in this journey of determination of how you knew that this was like you had to overcome all the producers saying, no, it'll never work and so on. And you nonetheless kept going.
Yeah.
Until it became the huge success that it was, a sellout success that, you know, as I was reminded in reading your article on post-immersive theater, people were actually touting tickets at the door. So what was this, you know, the journey of determination actually like, you know, how did you incorporate any learning experiences along the way around making performance in this way? Was there already a beginning of an interest in sound?
Well, yeah, I mean, with Hotel Madeira, the sound that I was going back to came from the northeast of Brazil. So when I went there with Jorge to sort of do some research and like just to hang out really, just to see, we were going to overnight rituals. And it was in the northeast of Brazil that we were looking at Cavalo Marinho and
Maracatu,
but also the Bumba Meu
Boy.
So these are three different like worlds, universes of different rituals with different stories, with different Afro-Brazilian heritages, different religions attached, different instruments attached, and different patterns of beats. And all of them, we were influenced by all of those. We took lots of things from the patternings, the way of dealing with audiences where there was no, obviously, where there was no stage or auditorium, where it was an event, it was a meeting and an encounter. So I think that backdrop gave us confidence because I had seen it, I'd grown up with it, Jorge had grown up with it, I knew it could work. We just needed to get it right. That was all. We just needed to like lock it in, and it all became about the invite. It was all located in the invite. How do we do this and invite people in the right way? And in the beginning, we invited people in the wrong way. And that's where the mistakes were made, and that's where the learning occurred. And that's when we had to also kind of translate cultural norms between, in a very crude way, I can say hot cultures like mine and George, because I'm Arab and he's Brazilian, and not hot cultures, not as hot. So the body is different, the way of interacting with human to human interaction is different, stranger upon stranger, negotiations, spatial negotiations, like, yeah, just all of that had to be things we knew inherently in our bodies had to be translated into a training to actors, to how to treat people. Things that we knew, things that we'd grown up with, had to now be related. And I think in terms of immersivity, our work was only really immersive on this layer. And that's where I feel a lot of things get it super, super wrong, because they do not have the depth of body experience that we were coming from.
But I was about to say, some of you are being far too rude. Thank you for the party and the celebration, and now my wife and I and the Golden Priest are leaving for another destination.
Go on then, please stay here. Don't let them out. Better here. Don't let them out. Act 5, the final battle for the Golden Priest. DJ? Better here. Don't let them out. Bang.
Ah!
And also because we also had previous experiences with how work can be exoticized to a Western audience, the last thing we wanted was to transpose some folkloric sounding work from Brazil and plonk it on a London stage. That was the last thing we wanted. We worked with the masters and we committed to having a half Brazilian cast because we wanted to have a complex set of languages and modes. So Otamadea wouldn't be only operating on the exotic level. It had to operate on a number of layers. So it became this mammoth operation because we wanted to get it right. So we invited DJ Dolores as well to create the soundtrack. Put DJ Dolores as a history of political engagement with folkloric traditions, and his music is predominantly digital, has been for a long time, electronic music, kind of the early Brazilian electronic music. So we were looking for these complexities, and that's when we started working with technology in terms of communication technology with the audience, because we knew that having this very strong, deep heat element of the ritual, the participatory rituals, the gestures, the kind of overwhelming sensations that audiences would feel, because we, as I just said, we knew they would. It would work on a human physical level. Needed to be also accompanied and followed by very nuanced other ways of interacting to carry them through the night, because we were there for 6 hours. You couldn't just keep on going for 6 hours on the same beat. So that's when we started looking also at instruction-based work. So sound and audio became not just the voice, the singing, the speaking voice, which was already there, not only the percussive rhythms that carried the rituals through the night that then were there, or the DJ'd exchange with audiences, then they started to become also instruction-based, game design-based, rule-based structures that we can have the audience experience something entirely new every few minutes. So they never feel like something is stuck during that whole period.
Yeah, and it was also there that we started looking at modern communication tools, wasn't it, in Otamadea, that would allow for new methods of interaction, you know, between the audience and the artists.
From 2006, we started experimenting a lot more with mobile phones, with closed circuit TV.
Mm-hmm. In terms of storytelling, I think, in terms of narrative itself, it was also not only about like how gameplay might be taken out of a physical environment and put into people's phones, like facilitated via, you know, phones, mm-hmm. but also how narrative and storytelling might result out of that. So yeah, like George said, those communication tools. I think that's really the beginning of when we started working with things like telecommunication, text, you know, really like lo-fi stuff, very ubiquitously.
And we used to talk at that time, from 2006 onwards, I remember us talking about not just being site-specific, but audience-specific and time-specific. And so the time specificity of Midnight to Dawn, the audience specificity in terms of how does my experience with my mobile mirrors Medea's experience with her mobile and Jason's experience with his mobile. How does that become intimate, not just as a funky tool, but where the technology becomes invisible? It's so integrated with the meaning of what's happening that I don't see the technology anymore. It just becomes another layer for me to enter this this universe.
Is there a way in which we can talk maybe about this process of translating a kind of ritual from one culture, i.e. Brazil, mm-hmm. where you spent time engaging with different kinds of rituals with the local communities, to another kind of ritual in what we might call a cooler culture by opposition to the hot culture? So what does a ritual in a cooler culture consist of? And how did that process of translation work for you?
I remember this guy.
Okay.
It's just an anecdote, sorry.
No, go ahead.
This guy, I don't know if you remember, after the first test we did in Salisbury, maybe he was in his 60s, almost 70s, glasses, kind of, he looked like someone who went to the theatre every week. And he finished Zero Hour Market, which was the first part, which was the most, let's say, Brazilian in terms of the amount of content from various researchers in Brazil. And at the end he said, at first I didn't really understand what was happening. And then I realized, the moment I realized I was a Brazilian,
I relaxed.
Yeah, and I thought, well, that wasn't our intention. But what that exposed is that permission. What he meant by when I understood I was Brazilian is another way of saying, when I was given permission to behave in this way, I loved it. So our thinking was, okay, how do we give people permission to participate, to behave, not just in the way that they're expected to in their culture, but in other ways?
Jad, you mentioned earlier the fact that you, when you were working with Paraactive, you were working in this context of the rave culture.
Yeah.
So on. I mean, was there any level of translating that particular experience into this particular show?
Yeah, actually. It's quite hard to sort of like pull back out the dredges of my memory, but for sure, because we were very into, and I still am, like very into bass sounds as a way of exciting the nervous system, right? So like working on sound on that level, and the patterning of the beats, like the repetitive, you know, in terms of like rave music, right, you've got this repetition. And in Hotel Madea we were working repetition of the drumming, which again is something that is completely linked. It's a way of keeping with certain drum beats can keep people awake all night. That's on a neurological level, on a psychoneurological level, we're working with those patterns. And where Paraactive left off was that although we were creating these like huge gladiatorial game pit or a sort of boxing ring, and you have audiences that are like booing for one character and cheering another, and we're trying to get them excited, they were still audiences. Even if they were in the performing arena, they were still always audiences. Whereas what George and I started to work with was a lot different, was the fact that we were in it in the here and now, and that we were sharing the same pulse, we're sharing the same breath, we're taking, you know, the same oxygen, and we're sweating next to each other. But I'm not just doing that thing of, well, maybe we did in bits of Hotel Madea, we did do that thing of we're acting and we're just acting really close to you and somehow that should be meaningful, which it isn't, right? But it was how to change people's behaviors. And I think that one of the biggest surprises to me as a Brit now is that I was really surprised at how little, if you did it in the right way, how little it took to unlock British audiences' sense of play, sense of wildness, sense of exposure, vulnerability, risk. Because the way I was approaching it was all wrong, which was something like, oh, you know, this is how people do it in these other cultures, and now we have to just teach, you know, we just have to bring it to England, and like then once we've taught them the right way to do it, you know, as if there was something wrong with them. And that was the wrong way round, because actually it just made us work much harder to find out the exact technical points of entry we needed to unlock an incredible amount. I mean, audiences are always underestimated, and we learned that. That was our lesson, is do not underestimate the audiences and what they will do and how far they will go.
And what was the secret formula that unlocked that?
Lots of different things. Physicality. Mm-hmm. We work a lot with physicality, with space, mm-hmm. with instruction, the right instruction, with never bullying, with mirroring techniques. I mean, there's lots, it just depends on the context. You know, we're working with this across many, many kind of different orbits. Like we're working in the orbit of sound. So what kinds of sounds, what kinds of presence, what does the actor need to be doing? I think there was a lot of actor training in how to stop acting and just be a human being that is making an invite to another human being. And I think we were really at the beginning of forging a vocabulary around that sort of invitation language, which I think from what I hear now, it's like, it's kind of becoming more commonplace, but then nobody was working like that. And we were kind of building the plane as we were flying it. The problem really was that I was in the show. And so I was directing the show as well as being in the show. And so through the show, I would be like, okay, that didn't work. We have to do that. And I would have to sort of remember, but there were many different types of how the actor had to use improvisation, had to use their voice, had to use their breath, had to be in touch with people. The level of touch, like this was a huge thing, which was to just to get invite. Maybe you could say that we were at the right moment because you're still in that slightly dirty, dodgy phase where we were taking liberties with audiences that I wouldn't now, not at all, you know, but in those days, because it was all new, a bit like punky, anything went. So I could just arrive and start taking my clothes off in front of another audience member. And they were like, here we are. I'm doing my stuff and you're just having to, you know, you paid for it. So it was lots and lots of different ways of interacting with audiences meant that there were lots and lots and lots of different techniques for different moments of the situations that we were creating. Each one required a nuanced and detailed and specific approach.
And the thing that became necessary and very clear for Hotamade and everything else that we did since is testing and testing and testing. One of the many problems around the overproduction of so-called immersive work is the speed at which it's demanded and the lack of experience and ethics behind it. And when something is tested or rehearsed, is done for the very people of privilege that usually that belongs. And so you have something made and consumed and tested by the same people and then wonder why it doesn't connect to a wider audience. Why it doesn't work. So we did at the time, and we tested Brazil in UK and tested in Brazil and tested in UK and tested in Brazil and tested in UK with different audiences, different venues at different times. And exactly so we wouldn't assume anything. We would be developing with the people this was by and for. We would be constantly engaging in this and any problematic thing that would emerge, excellent, we would address in the next test and so on. So by the time Hotamade was what it was, it couldn't not be that. It couldn't not have worked in that way because it's only the result of that iteration after iteration after iteration after iteration. So how do you do that without having that amount of infrastructure, expenditure, you know, a model that in terms of business doesn't work? It worked as a piece, but it can't just be replicated. So now it's about how do you embed that testing throughout any making process that is interactive or participatory.
Have you taken any of your work back to those Brazilian communities that have, in a way, given you some tools to discover these horizontal ways of interacting with the audience?
Yeah, we work in Brazil all the time. At the moment, in fact, we work with a project in a favela in Belo Horizonte. Mm-hmm. And that's phenomenal because we work with a group of young people who are very, very kind of gender fluid and concerned with LGBT issues. And they're sort of trapped between religiosity of the evangelical churches and between the police and between gang culture. So it's projects that are deeply meaningful to us. And what we tend to do is kind of just share stuff with them so that they also then make workshops. We're quite keen for them to be leaders in an educating capacity. So it's about sharing tools. So I would say that that's our main thing at the moment with Brazil. Would you say it's something different, Georges?
Yeah, I think, as I just said, one of the shocks of doing Hotel Madeira at the Hayward Gallery, as well as the tout selling tickets outside, was that who isn't able to access this work? And when we kind of realized that we'd spend that long making it, that so many people, ourselves included, had devoted so much of our lives, lives that we didn't spend with our young children, that we didn't spend with loved ones, money that we didn't have, why isn't it available to those that we would very much like to experience this? So we stopped to take stock. That's when we merged Paractive and Zakura Wood into ZUUK. And we took some time where we didn't go out and make any work and we didn't go out and exchange anything. We just sat and reflected and kind of tried to understand what can we extract from this learning and not replicate a model that doesn't work, that is exploitative to others and to ourselves. So it was from a few years after Hotel Madeira, we started going back more regularly to Brazil and also to Colombia, working with vulnerable artists in areas that are usually not supported or very barely supported in terms of artistic development, and do projects that shared methodologies and also equipment for makers who had an interest in interactivity but didn't have the tools, didn't have the equipment, they couldn't afford the equipment. And also with this group in La Favelinha in Belo Horizonte, where we would run workshops and go like, from any of this, is any of this relevant to you?
Well, it was sound, isn't it? Because they were they were mostly interested in how we were using headphones because of their DJing stuff. So that was the main issue.
We left a set of headphones, wireless headphones. We taught them how to use it and then some tools. And we're like, okay, what do you make with this? And then now they're creating mainly for sustainable fashion and this kind of income through sustainable fashion and performance. They use some of that equipment.
What is sustainable fashion?
So what happens is that in Brazil, very little gets thrown away anyway. Mm-hmm. But things that do get thrown away in the favela, they started a project and we worked with them on a project called Garota Haka, which is the name of our collaboration with them, to create a new fashion lines out of found and discarded clothes. So that's what the sustainable element is. And the work that we did with them specifically was just about kind of upskilling and also platforming. And they're already like really ahead in terms of being on, you know, Instagram, this and that, and this, like, they're all over it. But what we were bringing in was a little bit more of a backbone. They already were running a Favelinha Fashion Week, which was a fashion show. It's a fashion show. And it's only called Favelinha Fashion Week because they didn't know what week meant in English. They just heard it, you know, that fashion week. So they use this for the name of this event, which is the catwalking event. And in the favelas, there is, you know, what the favelas are like. They have lots of like narrow alleyways and passageways. And so they would use these alleyways and passageways as if it was the catwalk itself. So that's the project that we do with them. And they've come over to London as well. And we've done Bristol. Some stuff in London and Bristol. Yeah.
So then the next big show was Rio Phone Hack, which you did in 2015 in the Olympic Park.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell us about that. What was the idea there? What was the intention and how did
So it came out of another show called Humble Market. And we did Humble Market for the Olympics in Preston, in the northeast of England, and in Belo Horizonte, actually, funnily enough, Belo Horizonte in Brazil. Humble Market was this amazing show where we were using lots and lots of different kinds of vehicles. So there was like a huge empty landscape, and then these vehicles would come in. And I, at that time, I was thinking about it on a much more British level. So I was thinking about like an ice cream van and the sounds that it makes, the ambulance, a limousine, you know, really kind of iconic sort of vehicles. But then the funding we got, I think, was like across countries or something like that, which made the idea not quite as fitting. We did a version then, we did a version here, and we used a Rio taxi. We had a shaman in a van. We had like dancing gorillas and a kind of rave moment and a limousine.
Big church.
And a church. One of the things that we made was we managed to get hold of some, I don't know how this is so random, but some telephone boxes from in Rio. We worked with somebody called Alistair Elback here, who's a Manchester-based artist, and we still work together. And we just wanted to basically hack this phone. I just wanted to put like an experience inside the phone that would ring and you pick up and then there's some kind of interaction. So that's how it started, was back as one pillar in a five-pillared piece called Humble Market. So we took that out and started working on it alone because it didn't require any actors, you see. It was at a moment where we needed to be a little bit more quiet. So it was something that I could work on. I didn't have to, you know, work with actors and didn't have to have that the physical presence of other people. But we wanted to start making work for public space as well. And at that time, the Olympics was handing over between England and Brazil. So it was a kind of obvious sort of a link. And the phone is very, very iconic. The Brazilian phone, it has a very specific look. And the Aurelião is this big, you know, like a kind of like, I don't know if you've seen those. I think they might have them in America as well, but they're like an oyster sort of shape shell. And then you stand inside the shell. We just got to work, really started working on it and developing these pieces that were responsive to sight. And so it was all about like the audience member kind of being, you know, the participant being at the phone and what they could see and what they could experience, and me writing something that was totally unique to that spot, to that exact coordinate in the world. And we had one next to a river, so we made it a more of a meditation on the river. We had one on a bridge, so we made it about measurements and things like the measurements of experience, and then the other one was about in the middle of the hill thing, yeah, and that was a Brazilianification. That was more, much more of a light-hearted one. So we had these three phones. The thing about the phone, you know, the very cool thing about the phone is that we were working with just basically motion sensors and linking it in the beginning to Arduino, but then we moved to Raspberry Pi, and we were just making it so that when a person walked past it, they would trigger it. And then it would ring. First of all, the artwork already happened because it was there. And it was just so weird, like a Brazilian phone in the middle of the Olympic Park. And then the second mode of interaction would be this phone ringing. And then the third would be it picking it up. And then we also made versions which integrated, which triggered an actor. So you'd be on the phone and then, you know, halfway through the phone call, there'd be this like, a person, and the person would get very, very discombobulated seeing what's happening and this stranger, and it would be a very intense experience. And I think that is the exact point where all my work is located, in this sort of wait, what's happening? It's sort of like layers, you know, slippages in your perception, triggering these like very multimodal effects. So you don't quite know what way up you are and what you're hearing and what's real and what's not real. And so Rio Phone Hack is one that we've continued. There's still one up at the moment in Trinity Boy Wharf, for example, and we've done it in various places. But they're very useful because they are very quietly political. I think that's why it's sort of one of my favorite artworks, really, because of my voice and the way that it starts is all very unassuming. But then it starts to get quite edgy. And can be either uncomfortable on an emotional level, or it starts to get a bit uncomfortable politically. Like with the Olympic Park, I didn't quite expect them to be so involved in the script. And I thought I was going to get away with a lot more than I did eventually get away with. They did veto a lot of my stuff, and they sent the script back and they said, there's no way you're going to be saying this. So I was a bit shocked. You know, so Georges, like, did is, you know, a really great job of kind of negotiating between us, and it was hard because the land is very contested, you know.
We managed to, out of 14 requests to change, I think we only had to change one. Well, one thing that from Hotamadé to Rio Phone Hack is that you have this entry point for Hotamadé, which is really high, where you not only have to purchase a ticket, but you have to risk this whole night out is a time most of us are most vulnerable, not sleeping, not knowing what's going to happen in order to access that artwork. With this one, if you walk past and it rang and you decided to pick up, that's all you needed. So I think that was, as I just said, as wanting to go into public spaces to find out what do we gain, what do we lose, and what strategies can we use with a passerby. Is it possible to have a meaningful engagement with someone who wasn't expecting to find an artwork? And maybe someone who will leave that phone and still not call it an artwork, and yet have engaged with it meaningfully and talk to others about it in their own way. So I think that was a big shift in that way. And then every work since then is predominantly been about the public space.
So this line of your work that's about engaging with the public space or intervening in it, what's the sort of political, ideological background of the way in which you do this sort of work in public space?
I don't know if there's one defining thing. I would say that it probably, like Georges said, I think that there was an idea that, you know, once we got to South Bank, I think that there was probably just a little bit of an awakening there for me in particular, where I saw that the audiences were so of one type. There was a kind of eliteness and overprivileged, very, very white, very, very middle class. And, you know, I was like looking around, and it was that question of like, when did my world get so white? And I think that zipping all the way back from being there with that demographic of audiences to suddenly wanting to make work that was in the public space is part of that revolt, you know, against that. It was very, very new for me because I was really having a change of focus. Like I had really, not Georges, because Georges already was making a lot of, doing a lot of public artwork stuff when I met him. But my work, you know, coming from that Grotowski canon is all very controlled, and you want to sort of protect the energy and protect the space. And there's a kind of sort of like a sacredness to it. And there needs to be a formality around the in the space and out the space. So I found it very difficult to move into that realm. I think for me, the Olympic Park was my first moment of being really confronted with politics and art in quite a brutal, like, confronting way, that from then on, really, I was always looking at this public versus private domains. And since then, we're quite interested in POPs, which are privately owned public spaces, and why and how they mean for us as a society, and how they are very, very dubious in terms of neoliberal politics and what they mean for how we perceive the environment and what's actually really happening in terms of power.
Just about the private space, as Jaj was saying, that this resistance is really natural, I guess, if you come from a theatre environment. And I can also see how peers or other theatre makers might also have that embedded fear about the quality of the work, or the assumption that to put something in public, you have to lower the bar, that you have to do something not as good. That was very much a shift of paradigm, of understanding that there are layers to anything, there are nuances, there are modes. And so just like with the phone, you will have some engagements that are about someone admiring it from a distance, and that's all they're ever going to get from that artwork. And at others, there will be that moment of surprise of, oh, the phone is ringing for me, or is it? And then walk away. And there are others that will take that invitation and go, I want more, and they will stay. With the binaural dinner date, for example, it was about looking at a space that is not threatening to audiences. So a cafe, a restaurant, a shopping center, to the majority of people, this is not a threatening space. You don't need to have a sense of entitlement to enjoy those spaces. You're not going to a gallery or a theater or even a cinema that people will feel something about those spaces and who is allowed in them or how much it costs to get in. Whether they're paying or not, there's always a sensation of, do I belong here? Who else is in here? Kind of scanning the room and feeling like, is this for me? And if you're in a cafe because you're drinking coffee, because you're in there for a meeting, or because you're waiting for something else, and suddenly a little opportunity is offered, the fact that we dealt with A, the dating scenario, and B, the headphones, the earphones, the binaural earphones, means that there's two different access points that are very familiar and they're very little to do with art. One is you might meet someone, or you're already in a couple and you can do this together. The dating scenario might be threatening to other people, but not to anything to do with art. It's just, you get it. Oh, and you also know if you go into a date, it might be excruciating. It might be hard and embarrassing, but that's part of the universe of the date. You're signing up for that. But secondly, is that people are used to sitting somewhere and just listening into something for a little bit. It doesn't feel like you have to drive it or participate, or if you don't join in, you'll all collapse. Tables and chairs are also very secure. You know, you sit down, there's a table protecting you between the two people. So there's a lot of a sense of security in that particular piece, and other things in other pieces offer a lot of reassurances to people who might otherwise not want to not have anything to do with it.
Now, take your partner's outstretched hand and examine the lines on their palm. Take the pen and draw a little heart in the middle of one of the lines. Stand up and place your hands on the table. Lean forward towards your partner and close your eyes. Keep leaning towards your partner with your eyes closed. Open your eyes and stay standing. Hold both of their hands with both of your hands over the table and close your eyes. Here is the sound of your heartbeat, and here is the sound of theirs. Listen as your heartbeats begin to merge. It's cool to mock human sentimentality, but it's only fear, since to be really human is probably to be unavoidably sentimental and naive and gushy and generally pathetic. Open your eyes. Smile at your partner. You can sit back down now.
It's really interesting that your work then moves more explicitly into this territory that you talk about in your paper on post-immersive theater, that is the territory of empathy and care and opportunity to establish some sort of communication, meaningful communication with strangers and so on. So that's kind of starting to happen in the binaural dinner date, but also more explicitly in some of the other works that you are currently developing, like Good Night, Sleep Tight, and Pick Me Up and Hold Me Tight.
Thinking about like neurophonics for a small moment, I'm just talking in a very sort of crude way, how sound affects the brain. And if we believe that, and if we know that to be true, how does it then affect behavior? in terms of kind of, you know, psychoacoustics. We're talking about how sounds can connect people and also disconnect them, and what sounds internalize the human. I don't know if you know what the term entrainment is, but entrainment is basically where something that you're hearing or experiencing, there'll be a shared tendency on a physical or biological system to respond in the same way. So audiences could respond to music or to beats in the same way, and you can make a feature of synchronizing these responses. People have done it a lot with synchronizing heartbeats or their other involuntary systems like breathing and stuff. So for example, in East London Workers' Party, we use a lot of rhythmic Rio Funk bass tracks. And they were focused on choosing particular musics that were absolutely like impossible to stay still to. Like, they've got a very, very specific attack on the involuntary systems. And in Good Night Sleep Tight, it also did a lot of research online and stuff, reading from sound therapy. And my goal in that was completely the opposite. It was to lower and slow down the participants' blood pressure. It was to lower the stress levels, obviously, but also the heart rate. And I wanted to try to take it, you know, imagine like your goal, your end goal would be to take those levels to as near as possible to a death state. Good Night Sleep Tight is a VR experience that you do lying down in a bed, having been put to bed in pajamas with hot chocolate. It also is about death. So the child's bed that you start in ends up kind of as a sort of, you know, metaphorical deathbed. And we created music and sounds and a soundscape where the participant can follow the movements and the layers in the piece, which induce this sort of dreamlike state, but their heartbeat is going to naturally slow down because our heartbeats tend to match the track's BPMs. And so what was interesting is that the length is also critical. The length of the soundtrack cannot be like shorter than 5 minutes, really, because it takes about 5 minutes for entrainment to occur. And in Good Night Sleep Tight, we also used a child's voice, a six-year-old child's voice, which was like, has a very soft and sort of whispery quality, but it's like talking about death, and it has an effect, you know, these things, these sonic effects. The other thing, for example, that we use, which is opposite to what we've already spoken about today, is that there is no repeating melody. So in Good Night Sleep Tight, where you create signatures that don't repeat, and that allows your brain to completely switch off, because when your brain is no longer trying to predict what comes next, some part of it switches off and there's a kind of relaxation.
As you fall asleep, your body is recuperating on many levels, biological, physiological, as well as physical. The enormous level of activity that will occur as you sleep, dream, fix, mend, repair, and heal your body from your day, from your week, from your life. Think back, right back to a time when you had tiny hands. Remember when your hand was tiny, and the things you held were sometimes too big. A pencil, a cup. When you couldn't quite understand what the adults were talking about. When you still had no idea how hard it was going to get. Think back to when you were somewhat protected from the perils of the grown-up world. As your perspective of the world increases, the pain it inflicts on you changes. Understanding the world requires you to keep a certain distance from it. There are things too small to see, so you magnify them like atoms and molecules. There are things too big like clouds and galaxies, so we reduce them. We are always struggling to get that right distance between us and the stuff around us. Do you miss your childhood, or are you glad it's all over? Were you closer to your mother or your father? Did your family, on some level, disappoint you? What is it that was never nurtured in you? What could have been different? Do you remember trusting the outstretched hand and putting your little hand inside of it? As an adult, how much of you is still that child? When did you first become aware that life could be painful? Let's skip forward, right forward, as forward as you can get. Your death, the moment of your death, the moment your personal narrative comes to an end. What will it be like? Where will you be? Will a heart transplant operation have gone wrong? Will it be a nasty pile-up on an M25? Will it be in the nuclear holocaust started by a tweet too far? Will it be an elegant, peaceful death or a messy, bloody one? It's a difficult idea to think on. Think on. We are all going to die. The lifespan of each mammal on our planet is roughly 1.5 billion heartbeats, whether you are a mouse or an elephant. We will take roughly a half a billion breaths. How many have you already taken? How many do you have left? When will it end? When will we just walk without noise and open the door into darkness? And just how can it be? How can it be that it takes a...
How I work with sound is very physical. And then there's the instructional work, which I think is like a whole other, you know, talk, like what it means to give instruction to people. And it's interesting now, isn't it, in terms of us living in COVID and instruction, because everyone tunes in, like there was a moment, wasn't there, where we were tuning in to say, okay, what does the Prime Minister say? What do we have to do? What are our instructions? And we're listening out for those instructions. Our default position is to listen and to obey. But that requires trust. And the trust is completely broken. And after the recent last, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, which is the Dominic Cummings episode, people aren't tuning in the same way that they were. They don't give a shit what the new rules are. Everyone is just going to do what they want because the instructions were not to be trusted. They were not to be trusted. So this is really interesting, like in terms of like our work and how we give instructions. And I think all of our stuff is very, very different from instructional based work that I've seen in general. I mean, there's somebody who I know that you know, who I really love, you know, feel very aligned to her, which is Sylvia Makrugali, and her stuff is kind of something that I feel a lot of synergy with. Again, like she is a woman, she is a foreign woman. I don't know if it's something about that, but there isn't that use, that kind of normal voice that you get in headphone work that I find can be a little bit just too smug for me. It's just too middle class and very assured and very in control. And it is important to have control. Like control is something that is super important because we create very highly choreographed, very specific, personal experiences for people. So at a granular level, we're controlling and mediating every minute. There's a tempo rhythm that we keep to, especially in binaural dinner date. I really enjoy this, like this musicality to work. And I'm always thinking about when time is very elastic within a piece and where time is very digital. You know, digital is where a machine keeps the time. There's a click track. You've got 6 minutes. It's like this. It goes da, 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 you know, and things have to be delivered along that. But in musical terms, like when you have like live music, there's this phenomenon called the tempo rubato, which means like robbed time. And it means that you're in a swing. It's like a jinga. You borrow from this bar, but you have to give it back in the next bar. So stolen time is when you can take a little bit extra and then you have to give it back and you can sort of be borrowing. And that makes time very flexible. So in terms of performance and like how I see pieces, it is very much on this kind of tempo rhythm score. And I learned that really from the work with Grotowski, which was like to create a score for it to be very specific. In Binaural Dinner Date, it's less of like a show isn't it? It's much more of a sort of phenomena. You know, you do bunnel a dinner date. You
experience.
It's an experience. And in terms of using sound as a way to hear yourself, it is completely unique to other things that I've seen. Because a lot of headphone work is just you receiving. You receive, right? Which is like, which is normal, which is part of it. That's why it goes through the headphones and et cetera, et cetera. But in this situation, there are tropes that we have in common with other companies, I would imagine. A disembodied voice, for example, instructions, for example, poetic content. That's nice, makes you think of nice things, for example. That tends to repeat, doesn't it, over the sector, really. But I think what separates us from the other groups is that we're really, really always fighting for ways of audiences being able to speak and interact with each other and to create situations that augment that affordance, i.e., we usually have a mic, or we use special headphones in binaural dinner date that had microphones embedded in the mic, in the headphone, so we can open and close the headphones as we're going along. That approach that started with binaural dinner date, giving the audience a mic, is important to us because, and it's not about this idea of agency. Let me just be really clear here, because that's a different issue. That's a different subject. It's huge. I'm not talking about that right now. I'm talking about giving someone the microphone. Even that phrase in our culture is like, give him the mic or give her the mic. That means have a voice. That's the thing that is scored underneath that. It's framing the participant as the one that can speak. It's framing and elevating by literally giving her the mic. So that is important in binaural dinner date. I mean, lots of things are important, but that comes to mind. The other thing is this thing that I referred to earlier, which is like the slippages in time and space. Do you know what I mean? It's like when you think you're on this plane and you thought you were listening to something and seeing something, but it's actually live and you thought it was pre-recorded. We have a lot of games like that in binaural dinner date, and we're really interested in how you can experience the world and mistrust the world. You know, you have a voice that sounds like it's recorded, but then it slips into real time, real world, so actually it's live. Another example is where we recorded audiences at the beginning. Which version did you see, Dushka?
The one at Stratford Circus, you know, in the cafe at Stratford
Oh
Circus.
Oh my God.
It's okay. So that was 2017.
So it really moved on from there. Mm-hmm. Some new parts that we added in that you haven't seen. And one of those was being able to record the audiences when they sat down and playing it back to them, only to them, and then destroying the recording immediately afterwards. So you would repeat the audience's own conversation back at them and ask them to analyze it. And therefore, what you're doing is you're putting them simultaneously in the past as well as in the present. So there are all these like wormholes between time dimensions that I really think that sound can do for you in a way that nothing else can do. Nothing else can do that. So lots of these kind of glitching the matrix stuff that I really enjoy doing, that triggering these multimodal effects and also destabilizing the participant a little bit, so that in the destabilizing, you create a sense of unknowingness. And in fact, unknowingness or not knowing in the human being immediately affects a kind of openness and those sorts of behavioral states. With binaural, I think we made a huge leap in terms of headphone work. I think we really took things much, much further on than they are. And the next thing we're doing, it takes it on even further in terms of Brega, because it syncs with post-immersive manifesto. It's not like I'm trying to stay ahead of the curve because like I want to be cool or the rest of it. It's just that things get tired so quickly, as I think we speak about in the manifesto. You know, there is no avant-garde if the mainstream has already swallowed the avant-garde. You know, it's like there's no alternative, like there's no alternative scene.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing now and the technologists that we work with now is I'm very much thinking about building our own equipment. So making our own headphones. And we've started to do this at the moment with a really important bit of technology, which is the bone conducting headphones, because the bone conductors are not as all-consuming as normal headphones. They sit on your bone in your face and they bypass the ear canal completely, and they speak directly into your brain via your bone, which means that's not the important bit. The important bit is then your ears, which is your own natural sound technology, are open again to the real world. Right. And so that is something that we're looking at, where we're making pieces where audiences can just be normal, like you and I are being normal now, but I have to do it. I'm doing it now. I've got one ear covered, but I've taken this off so I can hear myself. Yes. So this is the same thing. The bone conducting kind of is doing that, but much better. And creating a lot of work where audiences can hear the makers, i.e. if there's instructions or if there's music that we want to play, but they can also just be in normal talk with each other.
Presumably that level is also accessible then to people who are hearing impaired, the bone conductor.
Well, it depends on the level of hearing loss. If someone can't hear at all, it depends also on that person's ability to interpret the vibrations, which is an area that we started working on, but it's very early stages. Mm-hmm. So similarly with binaural dinnadate, people who had hearing aids, we just had different types of headphones. The ones we use the most aren't compatible. So we would just swap that ahead of time so that people could adjust their hearing aids. But to shift to complete accessibility systems of deaf audiences, we're not able to do that yet. Okay. With, as I just said, with binaural dinnadate, we managed to create the social space where usually when you experiences are defined or described as immersive, or someone feels immersed by sound, it usually means sort of noise cancelling in your bubble world. When actually, if we are completely concerned with the space between strangers and how people create those social exchanges, then that is completely counterintuitive because it shuts you away from, you can only be a crowd, but you can't have an interactive exchange with someone. So in binaural dinnadate, you could do that, but was a system and a technology that is not mobile. You could do that. As long as you're sitting down on that table, we can map all those channels so you can shift without noticing from any kind of epic to intimate to this table to three tables to six without problem. With Quest, which is the one that we tested in Leeds last year, with the tattoo technology Jaj was just explaining, you can do that and people can be mobile. So you can be in a public space and you can move between spaces. People can come and go. That's why I guess it's such an exciting bit of kit.
So actually your paradigm shift to a more empathetic form of post-immersive theatre is also closely tied with technological development.
Mm-hmm. The thing we stress a lot about technology is technology is everywhere, from piece of paper, pen, to obsolete payphone, to high-tech new release. So we are no more interested in the latest technology as we are in the oldest technology. So
yeah, to be honest, the bone conducting actually is absolutely not a new technology. And in fact, binaural sound is like really old. It's way old. Like people think that binaural sound is now, but it's about 100 years old.
Right. Okay.
So I guess one example would be when we started developing binaural dinnadate, we were working with live 3D rendering, head tracking, you know, the full binaural kit. And the moment we realized that was putting people off of interacting with each other, we started removing bit by bit. And what we got left with was a very, very small fraction of what binaural technology can be. But we are not interested in being an expo tech fair to demonstrate the use of technology. We're interested in, does it work for this intended purpose? The moment it puts people off, it's no longer something conducive. So with Hotel Medea, the reason why we brought technology in is because we were literally looking at the audience's body. What are the ways that they receive information and experience the world around them? We were looking at embodied cognition. We were looking at sound, the image, and movement. And it just so happened that the mobile phone had become already an extension of our bodies. It vibrates, we feel it as if our body's vibrating. It's not a separate thing standing in the corner. So it would be silly for us to ignore that this is a pervasive thing that people feel very intimate with, that mobile phone. So it's sort of in that sense that this is a natural part of how people interact with the world with one another. And it might further this engagement that we're interested in exploring. And the moment that it doesn't, there is no, tech is not God in any way. It goes. The moment that it doesn't work for us, it goes.
How has your work been interrupted or not, or in some way stimulated, if possible, by the current situation of lockdown?
One thing that it has been really good for, which is why I was really happy to get your email and be able to talk about this stuff, is given me a lot more time to do a bit of research around the kind of sound projects and really what sound means from the optic of that kind of stuff that we were looking at in terms of like the emancipated spectator sort of world of agency and participation, and what the sound technology, current sound technology, and the affordances it gives us might be able to link in that. So like that's kind of what I've been able to spend a little bit more time doing.
Right.
Looking at like a new piece that I want to create with transducers and making sound come out of walls and using these prayers that I was telling you about, mm-hmm. that I learned when I was a child, and to create a kind of sound project out of that. But that's a very new thing, because the big thing, the Brega thing, is about people,
mm-hmm.
and about bringing people together. And it is very much about the 80s and 80s politics, and where it all kind of, where current neoliberal politics is flourishing, had its seeds sown back in the 80s. So looking
right.
at that.
Interesting.
When society kind of started to fall apart under Thatcher, mm-hmm. and seeing whether this kind of technology is a way of fixing society, a way of like going, oh yeah, this is how we used to talk to each other, and we used to mobilize, and we used to do these, and do these things still exist in our bodies, in our blood, in our DNA, or have we lost it completely?
Great. But presumably the pick me up, hold me tight,
yeah,
it's not affected by the social distancing.
Well, people going to the phone boxes,
right,
is going to be a problem, just in terms of whether they feel safe enough to like pick up things in there. But that will definitely happen, because it's so time based on the 1st of January.
Great.
Yeah, and I guess if anything, this period has just magnified what was already happening. So our interest in investigating intimacy became all the more relevant and pressing. You know, how do you redesign intimacy in a state of, you know, confusing government instructions, fear of infection, social distancing rules? So the redesign of intimacy for us is very important, and we're doing that again very incrementally, with testing different models without any rush to achieve anything straight away. And the other is continuing to challenge privilege, which is something that, again, was already at the forefront of our concerns. And with a moment where people are told to stay home or to connect only via technology, then the gaps become even bigger as people are forced to have to work and put themselves at risk or have to share a house with loads of people and so on.
Yeah.
So I guess the different fronts that we have at the moment during lockdown and post-lockdown are about engaging with our community of students, of peers, of colleagues, and testing things in a very kind of slow way in terms of what we're able to do or how we can support each other. And also modeling and kind of a transitional way, but instead of waiting for the government or universities to tell us what to do, we're trying to start now by just sustained engagement and testing, really. Testing is the way to create it together so that we are with everyone who is involved and who this is for. We are talking together and testing together and creating it together.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah, you're welcome. Ciao.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.